to the official podcast of the MERS Political News Center. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Simon Schuster. Abigail Walls will join us in a couple minutes when we're joined by our guest for the week, Eric Nesbitt, the head of the House Republican Campaign Committee and the House Majority Floor Leader. But first, Simon, Bill Schuette is certainly upping his presence here in the capital city, at least the last week or so while the lawmakers have been away. The Attorney General held a press briefing just this past week here with reporters, and essentially it seemed like it was just to catch up and shoot the breeze, but he had some things that he wanted to get off his chest.
Yeah, he did. He wanted to reiterate a lot of the rhetoric that he had previously said at a press conference in Flint when he announced a civil suit against the two engineering firms that are allegedly complicit in the water crisis there.
And not only that, he went into a little bit about his criminal investigation and how cooperative or uncooperative the administration has been with him.
Yeah, he didn't explicitly come out and say it, but when he was asked, he was very willing to say specifically that it was Governor Rick Snyder's private hired lawyers that were with, at least slowing up to some extent the investigation, not being fully forthcoming with all the documents that he had been, or rather his prosecutor Todd Flood had been requesting.
So this is pretty interesting here that with this Flint water crisis, before the beginning of the year, when we talked to Bill Schuette about it, he said, well, Dan Wyant should be fine. And before he knew it, Dan Wyant was out the door. And now Bill Schuette is seeing that this water crisis is something that his office has to devote an enormous amount of resources to. And he's really trying to make it so he is up front and center on all that is Flint water.
Yeah, certainly. I think some of the peril for his office as well in putting himself in such a prominent position is that he's also opening himself up to a considerable amount of scrutiny. Part of the roundtable, for a good portion of it, he was parrying some of the reporters' questioning and that were trying to press him on, you know, for instance, why his office was not part of the investigation. And he of course explained that there's no reason for it to be, but he didn't really go into much further detail other than that. Reporters had also asked him if he had heard of anything, you know, concerns with the water from Flint residents before the announcement of his investigation. He said not to the extent of his knowledge, but again, he was not very specific.
So here we are with a water crisis back in 2015 where folks were complaining about smelly, colorful water. And yet he claims that he didn't really know anything about it, and it was really not until January that he got out in front of it. Was that believable?
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of the question that much of the media is having now is that you have an office that purports itself to be the chief investigator for the people of the state of Michigan, I think some reporters find it hard to believe that no one had come to him with their concerns about this water when their other concerns, you know, for at state and city officials had fallen on so many deaf ears.
So what were some of the more interesting questions that you heard during this press conference?
Well, he was very wide-ranging. He talked about his opinions on, you know, the Orlando mass shooting, the Second Amendment, Trump's candidacy. And I think it was very interesting that he's taken the position on Trump's nomination that he will support the candidate as a matter of party loyalty, but he didn't seem to go as far as endorsing his platform.
And not more than 30 minutes after his press conference wrapped up, we get word that his office is filing charges against the state representative from the 1st District, Brian Banks, who has had no shortage of run-ins with the cops based on his faulty reporting and bad check writing in the past. In this case, we find out that back in 2010, when he was trying to get out a loan, allegedly, he had somebody cut him old check stubs that were not legitimate, and he used those check stubs in order to get a loan of some $7,000 to $8,000. Now, 6 years after the fact, the Attorney General is charging him with three felonies and a misdemeanor in regards to this, and presumably he did it a day before the statute of limitations was set to toll. So, Simon, we have this, we have Flint water, we have the Todd Corser, Cindy Gamrat investigation. I think it's pretty safe to say that he is not missing an opportunity to get in front of the people with his name and his office.
No, I don't think so. And I think the biggest mystery out of this media roundtable overall was why he would spend almost 45 minutes chatting with reporters, essentially shooting the breeze on any number of topics, and then not divulge what ended up being the biggest development from his office of the day. It seems to be that the only rationale could be for more press hits.
Well, it could be, and maybe it's possible that he wasn't in communication with his chief criminal prosecutor. It seems hard to believe that he didn't know this was coming down the pike, but then again, maybe we can give him the benefit of the doubt. his name out in public. I think it's fair to say that he is raising his profile with this, his attacks on clean air policy set by Barack Obama, as he is gearing up for possibly an announcement of a gubernatorial run for 2018. Do you think that's a pretty fair assumption?
I would certainly say so. I mean, he cast his litigation against the EPA as a matter of constitutional principle. He's definitely making steps to really assert himself as someone of consistent conservative values, and something that he hopes, I think, will resonate with voters come this next election cycle.
All right, Simon, let's move off Bill Schuette for a second and talk about Brian Banks. We'd mentioned his legal troubles just a few minutes ago, but now what is going to happen with the House Republicans and Brian Banks? Now the question is are they going to go ahead and use this Brian Banks situation as a campaign issue, as has been done by prior House Republican leaders? If you remember back in 2006, Craig DeRoche had tried to use the legal troubles of Burt Johnson to try and win him some seats, and particularly Oakland County. And here's an opportunity where he has already this session expelled one member for indiscretions and being a general nuisance and embarrassment to the caucus. We have now somebody who's got criminal charges filed against him. Now, Brian Banks is obviously a lot different than Cindy Gamrat and Todd Corser, but they're similar in that they have issues out in front of the public that can be used. Now, if Kevin Cotter and the rest of the House Republicans want to go down this road, this is an opportunity where they could again do expulsion hearings if they'd like. Here's somebody who's got criminal charges against them. As, I guess, you know, you could say, well, Virgil Smith had criminal charges and nothing was ever done with him, but Virgil Smith went ahead and worked with the Senate Republicans to get some things done. I have a hard time believing that Brian Banks is going to start cozying up with the House Republicans and giving them key votes on particular issues. To the contrary, we're seeing something completely different, where Brian Banks has got together the traditional Democratic interest groups and have the wagons circled around him to try and protect him against what he sees as being a partisan attack. He's already had one rally where he got the unions together and he got the trial lawyers down there. He even got the Health and Hospital Association down there, along with local activists, saying, hey, what's going on down here? It appears to me that there are politics being played. I'm not going to opine whether this was a political hit or not, but I will say that Republicans could use this as something they could put up on the board and say, should we have this member still here, considering his past charges, considering that if he's convicted here, he could face life in prison? Is this somebody that we want here in this chamber at this particular time? And let's say he puts up a vote on expulsion. I'm not saying he will, but let's just say that he does. He puts up an expulsion vote in September, October. He gets the Democrats on record. And let's say they don't get the votes to do that because the Democrats hold firm and say no. Then can Kevin Cotter turn around and say, are these the people you want in charge? These are the people who are defending somebody who's got a criminal record as long as our arm, and yet they want him to stay here in this chamber. It would be a risky move in some respect because there could be some blowback from various parts of the state. However, it's something that they now have at their arsenal that they didn't have before, and something that they can use. Now, we've asked the House Republican leadership what they thought of this Brian Banks situation. They said they are taking a wait-and-see approach. They want to see how the charges fold out. And so, obviously, have not made a decision what direction they're going to go, but it's something that we're going to follow and see what happens.
Joining us now is Eric Nesbitt. He is the House Majority Floor Leader. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're in the middle of the summer now, and the candidates should be fully engaged now in their campaigns for the primary. Tell me who's impressed you so far as a new candidate, maybe somebody that we haven't heard of.
Yeah, I think there's been a few that have impressed me so far. Bob Howie down in Pat Somerville's seat, very active person in the community, a local elected official who's working his tail off in the tradition of Pat Somerville. Joe Bellino, actually, in Monroe County. He's making some waves down there in northern Monroe County. Very
That's
happy.
That's the LaVoie seat, right?
Yeah. So he's working hard and out there very, he has good name ID, and he's a very popular individual in the business community. down there. And then there's just a whole number as you look at the open seats that we have. I think we have top-tier recruits in every one of our open seats. I think the Dems had quite a few misses in terms of their recruitment. And as I look at these primaries, I mean, we have a lot of primaries around the state, but it's something that I'm excited with the recruits that we have and as we continue to reinvent Michigan.
Talk about some of these competitive primaries that you're seeing. Which ones are you most interested to see the results in?
Well, naturally, our priority seats in terms of where it matters in terms of the fall and in terms of the majorities. And so, but you look around the state so far, I've been happy with the way the primaries have been going forward. People have been talking about their background, their issues, getting known to the voters, and trying to work to increase their favorabilities and their name ID, while also making sure that they're accessible, available to the voters around the state. We've been in the majority now. This is our sixth year. We're not taking anything for granted. 4 years ago was a very tough election year for us. We came back with a strong majority of 59 seats, even though we lost six seats and picked up one open seat, but it's the quality of the candidates, no matter what the election year is. For example, in 2012, going from a Lisa Brown to a Clint Kesto, and that was our one pickup of the year, and that was a good quality candidate that, you know, had a competitive primary, but those that usually work the hardest and get out there, that come out of the primary, usually are the best ready to go after it in the fall.
Are there any seats that you think are going to be kind of like a test balloon or are going to be particularly impacted by split ticket voting this cycle?
Well, I think as you look around the state that you're voting for the individual instead of for the party. I think that that's something that as you look around the state, that the quality of the candidates that we have in terms of their own favorabilities and their own connections with the districts, that I do think that this is something where instead of voting for the party bosses and the parties, that you're voting for the individuals, you know, and this is the first election cycle probably in my lifetime that we've had that option. And so as I look around the state, I'm happy with where our candidates are. And then, you know, some of the Dems chosen candidates in their primaries just like 2 years ago didn't even come out of their primaries. And we're watching those on the Democratic side with the number of primaries that they have and seeing who actually comes out of there. As we've seen traditionally this year in some of these seats that could be competitive, a lot of times an extreme liberal comes out of the primary, and that's something where, you know, that district is more of a center-right type of district. I see that in terms of my own seat 2 years ago when the Dems were talking about how competitive that was going to be, and they nominated an extreme liberal person to run against me, you know, somebody who supported, you know, taxpayer funding of abortions and full-throated support of Obamacare and anti-gun right on down the list, and she didn't do too well even after they spent $250,000 against me. And you see that around the state. We've had candidates in the past like you know, Ed McBroom and Tony Forlini that are traditionally competitive seats, but they fit their districts like a glove. Mm-hmm. And I think we have folks that will come out of those primaries that will continue that tradition of being available, accessible, earning the trust of the voters in their district and the trust of the families in their district instead of those up here in Lansing.
Give me the names of some extreme liberals that you see in some of these competitive districts who would be ripe for the picking. Give me some names.
Well, I mean, you have a whole number. I mean, you look at Teresa Bed, Colleen Lamonte. I mean, they don't have primaries, but they're extreme liberals that are there. Hosma and his voting record on the county commission has been an extreme liberal that's there. As much as you know, they want to cover up in the Representative McBroom seat with the sheriff up there, at the end of the day, he's going to be voting for an extreme liberal like Tim Grimmel for the Democratic leader. And do you want somebody that you can trust? Or do you want, you know, to put somebody in that'll follow the tradition of Barack Obama and Jennifer Granholm in terms of incompetent management of the state? And so you look around, Harvey down in Jenkins district, I think he's
Harvey Schmidt.
He's an extreme. Again, his record as mayor and his statements, you know, as I mentioned, Annie Brown's back again, extreme liberal. John Fisher in Representative Iden's seat, far left candidate that has made, you know, comments, you know, has protested against Israel and other extreme comments. And so it's something you see across the state that I think you have this battle within the Democratic Party, and you saw it within primary over this last year between Hillary and Bernie Sanders of this extreme left that Bernie Sanders represents, and then also, you know, this I guess you could call it crony capitalism, that Hillary Clinton are just not trustworthy. I mean, she just can't be trusted. And you saw this battle that went on, and it's going to be interesting to see with the top of the ticket as divided as the Democratic Party has been, whether they, you know, who actually shows up and votes this fall.
First of all, what's your personal feelings on Donald Trump?
I think Donald Trump is somebody that, you know, he's going to be our nominee for president, and he's somebody that I think people view as had a history of being able to get things done, make deals, and be able to, you know, at least his business experience, you know, move his companies forward, and has built quite the business. Is as you look at Washington, D.C., the frustration on both sides of the aisle. People are just sick and tired of the elites in this country. You've seen that with elections in Germany and then most recently with the Brexit and United Kingdom, where people are really tired of this partisan bickering that goes on in Washington, D.C. and want to see results. And I think a lot of folks see Donald Trump as somebody who can make deals and somebody who can get things done and somebody who opposes the status quo of what we've been seeing in this country for the last 8 years.
So do your House candidates run from him, run away from him, or is it depending district by district?
I think as you look at it, it's up to the candidates. And I'd say that he's our nominee. I'm a Republican. I'm going to be supporting, you know, Donald Trump. And it's something where each candidate has to take their own, you know, gut check of who they're supporting. If you're not supporting Trump, my concern is you're supporting Hillary Clinton if you're voting for the third party. And that's very troubling over the next 4 years with the Supreme Court justices that will likely be up and that need to be filled, especially as you see some of these decisions or lack of decisions being made by the Supreme Court. And so I want a rule of law justices that are in there. And I think the choices are very clear on who will appoint rule of law justices. Donald Trump will. Hillary Clinton will appoint these extreme left that want to change America for the worst. And that's just something that is just not acceptable. And as you look at around the state in these districts, that Hillary Clinton has a lot more negatives and a lot more baggage in the districts I'm looking at than Donald Trump does. And so that's something where, you know, the Democrats continue to be excited about Donald Trump's candidacy. Fine, I think it's going to be bringing some new folks out. And I think in the districts that we care about, whether it's Monroe County, Downriver, Detroit, Macomb County, Northern Michigan, I'd much rather run with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket than Hillary Clinton at the top of the ticket. Only 1 in 5 voters nationally believe that Hillary Clinton's honest and trustworthy. 20-some percent. That's it.
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. So you're okay with some candidates running with Trump or using Trump on the campaign if they feel like it's advantageous or if they like him?
These are all individual seats. They have to make a name for themselves. Again, we talked earlier about straight ticket voting. You know, they have to make a name for themselves and individualize it. And I'm sure the Democrats are going to paint a broad brush with some of the comments that Trump has said or other things coming after our own candidates. But it's just not believable. Each person's their own individual being.
All
and
right.
It's something as a Republican, you know, I'd have the expectations to support the Republican for president.
All right, so this is July 4. Give me your prediction. The Republicans will have how many seats when it's all done?
60-plus.
Okay, 60-plus. Let's touch on energy because you've been the shepherd of that legislation. What are the odds of some energy reform legislation reaching the governor's desk by year's end?
I think they're good. I think we're continuing
50%,
to work.
50%?
80%? Oh, I think they're better than 50%. You know, if you can predict 100%, you're probably in the wrong business. But I feel very positive about working on making sure that we get an energy package that takes care of the long-term capacity issues here in Michigan to make sure that when you switch on the power, that the power is actually there and that we don't have rolling brownouts and blackouts, and that people are, you know, whether they're a big business, a small business, an individual or senior, that nobody's subsidizing other people. There's a true cost of service that's in the system, and that we get away from these tired old, you know, mandates and higher prices that we've seen in the state.
Primary reason this has been delayed is because of?
It's a complicated issue. It's something where you have to spend a lot of time studying the issue and working through what it actually means. I mean, it took me a year and a half when I first came in, and I had an energy background, and I enjoy energy issues, and it really took me a solid year and a half to get a good grasp of the pros and cons and the different issues dealing with, whether it's dealing with long-term capacity or renewables or energy efficiency. And I'm still learning new stuff every day. And it's something that you have experiences from other states. And when you see other states, such as Ohio Governor Kasich a few months ago saying that wasn't the smartest option to go down the deregulation path, when you see a Republican governor of Maine trying to re-regulate because he says it's, you can't build any new generation in Maine, and when you see it stopped in California in the early 2000s because of brownout, you know, Gray Davis, you have experiences in these other states, and how do you ensure that you have the proper capacity and the long-term capacity to make sure when you want to start your plan up that the electricity is there, when you turn on your light switch that it's there, and that you have reliable, affordable rates here in the state.
Eric Nesbitt, the House Majority Floor Leader, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here, and happy 4th of July.
That's going to do it for this edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the Senate Majority Floor Leader, Eric Nesbitt, for joining us, Simon Schuster, Abigail Walls, little Neil Diamond, for our first ever 4th of July podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for listening every week. I'm Kyle Malin. Till next week, take care. Today.